But not swear out loud.
You can swear as much as you want.
That's right.
Again, within reason.
Within reason.
There still has to be some sort of common thread held throughout the conversation.
How about uncommon threads? That could be a nice clothing store.
Okay.
I do professional names.
So, my friend, the reason we have the topic tonight that we have, which
is the
cyberpunk apocalypse.
Oh, boy.
So, my dear friend Magpie is the editor-in-chief of something called Steampunk Magazine. And they had a little subsidiary zine that came out, which was the Steampunk Apocalypse. So, that was all about how steampunks would survive the apocalypse. And these are the steampunks that want to build shit and take things apart and make them work with steam power, not the people that want to dress up like Neovix and go dancing. Though I suppose they could
steam
do that
power,
as well. Steam power, yeah. So, he and I were talking, and he wants to write a similar zine, but for futurists and cyberpunks. And we got into a discussion about what it would be like to survive an apocalypse as a cyberpunk or a futurist. So, there are all sorts of apocalypses. Apocalypse. I mean, you can have natural disasters, you can have government collapse, you can have
electromagnetic pulse kill all of our...
Exactly. And
a new religion that comes along and...
wipes out everything, it's true.
Or an old one.
Yeah.
Or not so old, but...
Yeah. So, and how the ideals that we present in this group and the tools that we know about what can actually be constructed without necessarily the amazing systems of transportation and production that we have in place now. So I thought that'd be cool to talk about.
I think it depends on how much technology you have at the time.
Right.
And if you have the ideas about where things might go, then nothing's going to survive.
Yeah.
And if you have some technology and you might get an enclave, then that would survive. Potentially. And then spread again.
Yeah. That's a good point. Especially, this is one thing that he and I talked about was with MakerBots and such. It takes a lot of work, but if it's just the system that's collapsed and not the ability to produce things necessarily, then you can still be making little things and then build them into bigger things. And I think that's interesting, but then what happens when you run out of material?
Well, theoretically, this is ABS. You could take and chop this up and extrude it into another filament and reuse it. There's no reason why you just can't reuse this stuff again and again and again.
Okay.
Especially PLA, which is polylactic acid or something like that, which is you can grow, it comes from corn, so you can grow your own crop of it and then do whatever they do to make it into a plastic.
They're doing it with hemp now.
There we go.
Hempcrete is a lightweight concrete.
Oh,
instead of adding fly ash, which has mercury in it, hemp has just hemp in it. And there's this whole revolution going on right now because they're trying to formulate spray insulation that's 100% hemp. Right now, the soy mixed with urethane, which is already starting to go in that direction, but soy is food and it's not the way to go.
Yeah.
So what's happening is, even before we get to the assemblers of our future, people are assembling right now living things that can be converted into houses. And those houses can generate their own power. And so each house becomes a little factory, and in effect, for maker space or whatever you want. So how we survive the next, as you said, where are we on the ladder at that moment?
And also you have to be somewhere where you have a good climate for growing.
No, you don't. No, you can grow everything in earth sheltered greenhouses in the Arctic. In fact, I brought something, because is this the official start?
Yeah,
I want to share something which was going to be before the start, but I gave it up right on time.
Bioshelters.
Yeah, that's what these are.
Yeah.
I finally get the renderings.
Yay, all done.
Yeah. And these are things that are made out of spray technology and then earth sheltered, and you can do the same thing for your greenhouses and be in sub-zero weather. In fact, it works better when you're in cold weather because you can use heat pumps from the ground. The difference in temperature. But these are structures we're going to be actually hopefully making over the next year.
Really?
Yeah, we're looking at land right now in all places in Port Ludlow.
Oh, cool.
Timber company has a bunch of land in 80 acres for half a million.
Growing these crops in Antarctica be difficult because would growing these crops in say the Arctic or Antarctica be difficult because you don't have much sunlight?
You don't need that much sunlight. You have the same amount of sunlight, remember you have 24-hour days.
Right.
Okay. So during that time, are you talking about the heat or the light?
The light.
Well, then you can't grow plants. You have to grow plants that can tolerate short seasons. But for temperature purposes, you're not in trouble.
Okay.
Because the things I've seen in Sweden and Canada are centered around that same idea. They're powering whole villages with heat that's stored in caverns. So it's seasonal heat. It's not oriented towards south-facing houses. These are things that run for long, long periods. So if you're talking about post-apocalyptic, you don't want to have to charge your system every day.
Yeah.
Do it on a seasonal, you know, an annual basis.
Yeah.
So that's where I think a lot of this is going, is to be more autonomous. These houses are essentially like mini factories in that really all you need is you know, coherent electricity and you're off and running.
Mm-hmm.
You make your own electricity fairly easily.
But good power takes more effort.
Yeah.
I mean, I've made all kinds of crappy power meters, but stuff that you really want to run your machines on. But now there are inverters and all sorts of stuff that are much better than those.
So what's the state of solar power technology?
Solar power is something that is not worth doing the way it is right now. Meaning, these ponds are, these drones, these are the solar collectors of the future. They're not billboard-sized things up on a house. Because if the house is an earth shelter, then where are you going to put your sun? So the sun is collected underneath the water in closed, basically they're collectors that are hermetically sealed. And so what happens is the sunlight penetrates the water a few inches. The water is always rippling, which enables the sunlight to go through at the right angle. And then about 6 to 12 inches underwater, in kind of like a semi-submerged state, they basically have the right buoyancy to be under. Sunlight penetrates, water circulating in there separate from the water in the pond. The pond water is just for the aesthetics and to give it a little bit of a thermal balance.
Oh, wow.
But the thing itself is insulated. And then the hot water goes through a series of coils, through thermal siphon effects, goes up from here into the underside of the house, which is rock. The rock is heated, and you're off and running. It takes about a year to charge the system. But then after that, you have a year.
The state of general solar power is... So you build solar panels that are made out of silicon.
Okay.
Which is the most present element on Earth, because it's sand, basically.
Right.
And the more refined it is, the more efficiency you get out of it.
Right.
But we're now capable of refining silicon to the point that we're making orbs out of it, crystal orbs. So it's just, there are no impurities in it, and it's done in such a way that it, you know, crystals are the patterned nested atoms. I need a piece of paper, but that's okay.
But you know, on that thing, just a quick
okay. So, and this is sort of a side note, but now they're making the kilogram will now be the number of silicon atoms, instead of using the old weight system where you compare, because that changes, that fluxes all the time. So crystals end up being very structured, as opposed to the kind of mess of atoms that it...
Well, they have the amorphous type, and then they have now the thin film solar bouquets. That's what I was going to get to. I was going to say that aside from going underwater for the thermal part, you can also have the photovoltaic film as opposed to wafers. It's sandwiched in between glass. And so you can use it for your upper windows. It's translucent, but not transparent.
Uh-huh.
So you can now get much more efficient and not have to have standalone systems that blow down in the wind and cost a fortune.
Yeah.
So it becomes your tinting, so to speak. Your tinting actually generates power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here's a question as far as... If those systems go away, how do we make that?
Yeah, my question was, what I'm getting at is, if we lost industrial manufacturing capability, what would it take for us, armed with only our knowledge, to go out in the wilderness and create our own solar panels?
It'd be pretty darn hard.
Basically, like in like at the time of the gold rush out here in the West, like in California, like they would just basically like sometimes it would be as simple as just taking a black pot and putting it out, or painting the boiler black and putting it out.
But that's temperature.
Yeah.
Heat is easy to get.
Yeah.
It's ordered electricity that is the right frequency and voltage. You know, in other words, making solar panels for heat would be no effort at all.
It's cheap.
It's cheap, it's easy. Anything that's black and insulated with a cover glass would work. I mean, I made it with recycled tin cans in a bucket of water.
Have you seen anything about that solar Stirling engine?
Yes, I've worked with it. And
yeah,
they're
cool.
Fluidines.
Yes.
And you can easily run them in this climate. But what I'm developing right now, which I don't mind admitting to everybody, you know, everybody's going to go steal it, right? Lots of luck, you know. But we're working on a thing that uses natural contour of a hill, okay, to generate electricity by having wind that goes from the cold side to the hot side come through, and that air turns an air turbine, not a windmill up in the air, but something underground. You say, how can you possibly get the wind underground? I'm not putting wind underground.
Oh, no,
it's just
a thermal
differential.
It's a pipe. It's like a cave. You have natural airflow through a tunnel.
And I calculated it, and I'll tell you, forget the windmills. I mean, they're only good because they're up there, right? But if you add up the plate size, the actual surface area that's acting on, and you add up a bunch of windmills, you can get more efficient with a turbine, an air-powered turbine.
And along that line, as far as converting something like that into electricity, you can build a Wimhurst machine from parts from Home Depot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's a guy in Africa who did it out of just spare parts like Rogue Warrior. I mean, really, that's really...
But the hard part is if you don't have a grid around you, you're still up the creek. Just electricity won't do it. You've got to have batteries.
Battery.
Yeah.
And if you don't have batteries, then you have to do pump storage. You pump water up someplace where the pump is going variably.
Mm-hmm.
Water is pulled off continuously at a controlled rate, which then can spin a hydro turbine.
Okay.
That would work in primitive conditions. But the bottom line is going to be, where do you store your electricity?
That's true.
Well, that's going to be my next question.
All right. That's the toughest.
If we still have do you know our topic for tonight, both of you?
Yes.
Yeah. How are we going to make batteries out of sand?
I have no objection.
We're talking about how cyberpunks and futurists might survive the apocalypse, if there is an apocalypse, using those ideals and stuff.
Something else that's interesting is that the solar panels that are, you think it takes a lot of energy to make them, but there's no reason why they can't last indefinitely if it's not broken,
mm-hmm.
Because it's made out of glass, and like there was a talk with this one guy, and they can last, theoretically, forever, 600 years would be no problem,
mm-hmm.
for some of these panels to last, because there's nothing that can go wrong with them.
There is.
Yeah.
They corrode. They corrode terribly, the junctions. The problem is that, this is a contradiction, but a solar panel that's meant to be in the sun is not as efficient if it's in the sun, in the sense that it gets hot.
Yes.
And you want to cool them. So that's why we said, look, if you're going to use solar panels, either amorphous crystal or gallium arsenide, or more advanced, sandwiched forms of film, that you need to cool them, just like an atomic plant.
That's the reason they do better in the Arctic, actually.
Exactly. The efficiency is 10 times that in the equator. You'd say that can't be, but it's not about heat. And it's not even, because you have, 24-hour sunlight days in the Arctic. So you can have long, long periods of, heavy sunlight that's coming into your system.
As far as storing energy, I think if there were still enough cars around, you just steal all the batteries.
The batteries would wear out.
Yeah, they go away.
They'll go away. And
those early electric cars that were made in the 1900s and they have batteries?
Those batteries don't wear out, by the way.
No, those are very good.
Yeah.
But they're very good.
They
the acid in them, it's not a good thing you might have an accident with.
Right.
And they blow up.
Nickel iron batteries.
Yeah, the old ones. Right.
They're big, heavy, and they last forever.
They were strong.
They're still using them. They're like 90 years old. They use them
on ferries?
No, they use them in cranes. For those big digs, they actually have them, and that's what they use them for.
Interesting. Because electric motors are still terrific. I mean, even though they're so old, going back to the 1800s, late 1800s?
Yeah, something like that. Well, Jay Leno has one.
Yeah.
So
this is amazing.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I think the answer to the question, though, is not using electric. Basically, it's using your energy to pump water somewhere or to compress air, depending on how sophisticated your technology is. You can pump air, you can do compressed air, which can run an air turbine.
Mm-hmm.
You can pump water, you can do hydro turbine. But the trick is you have to have whatever you're doing going constantly at the right frequency. Even if you condition your electricity after you generate it, you have to do it very carefully. Because, I mean, the power companies earn their money keeping that frequency, you know, right where it needs to be, 60 hertz.
Yeah.
Sometimes. So, but you watch the variations on there. You get, like how on Vashon, I get to see a lot of anomalies.
We're on a boat, and I've heard the marina. And when lots of computer equipment failures.
Right.
The reason why having your own power is nice.
But then again, like usually when you don't have sun, you have wind, and vice versa. Because sometimes people don't realize that.
Yeah, I think you could get best combined.
So let's talk about what we would.
That's good. Go ahead. I think I might have.
I think the ability to build your own infrastructure. Means really important.
What do you mean by infrastructure?
Well, for instance, being able to make batteries, being able to make a windmill, because you're not going to be able to go out and buy something. You basically have to fend for yourself. And
right.
it's fine if you have it and it's already set,
mm-hmm.
But then at some point you're going to have to be able to replace parts that are going away, so you can't. Ideally, what you should be able to do is build a windmill from scratch, which
right.
means that you need to be able to do everything it takes up to that point,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a daunting task, I think.
Well, what do you think the, after basic amenities of food and safety, et cetera, are taken care of, what would be the most important thing?
Books. Communication.
Books, writing down your ideas.
Books, communication, what did you say?
Emotion.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with both Rod and
Lee.
Culture. I would say healthcare. Without healthcare, we're all going to be in trouble because that's part of living longer now. If you get rid of all the health advances and sanitation and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, sanitation is always important.
If you're cutting your own wood and you chop yourself with an axe.
Then what do you do? Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
I had that happen. I chopped myself, but I got a piece of the axe broke off and went in my leg, and I had to go like an hour and a half.
So you know.
So it's awful.
Ideally, everybody would have medical training.
Right.
And you'd be able to that on the spot, but then you'd have to have antibiotics and everything else.
There you go.
Yeah.
Pharmaceutical
so
industry.
Are we talking about surviving on your own here, or are we talking about groups of people staying together?
I think groups would probably work a lot better.
So
absolutely.
If there are groups, then there's going to be people who know how to treat.
But you need materials. You can have the greatest doctors in an African clinic, but if they don't have any antibiotics or simplest things, you're in trouble.
So I assume people who knows how to make those things
but
out of plants.
No, they're not easy to make, I'll tell you. My background is medical devices, which is hard enough, but pharmaceuticals require such an enormous level of sophistication. It's not just the technology per se, it's the sheer number of people and disciplines to make a little pill. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
There's not a culinary herb or spice in use that doesn't have some medicinal properties, so you
Many
find the guy.
But you can't get them all. You know what I'm saying? You can get, I mean, aspirin comes out of a natural source, right? But you want to refine these things, otherwise you're chewing something and one day it's 500 milligrams, the next day it's 3 grams, and the next day you die. You know? So there's something to be said more for psychedelic experience, I think, as far as, you know, taking more chances with Mother Nature. But for medicinal, you know, relying on it for serious treatment, you know, it's good for, like, you have a stomach ailment or your dandruff or something. It's lots of good stuff. But I don't think that they're at the level that we would need, especially if we had reduced sanitation, reduced food quality.
There's no reason why you should have reduced sanitation, reduced food quality. In fact, they probably have better food quality than you're getting it out there right now. I mean, because if you're preparing your own food,
yeah.
or with a group of people that your life depends upon, they're probably not going to, I mean, you're going to wash your hands, you're going to do these things where, you know, sanitation is probably a bit better.
Well, you know, I would agree with that almost generically, but a friend had a problem with a commune that she was involved with. They canned their own food.
Oh,
botulism.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's easy in one hand, but you still have to be sophisticated.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because the old days, you could say that way back when, You know, we knew what, we had those skills. So the irony is that as we've gotten more advanced, we've also unlearned a lot of grandma's canning techniques and stuff that if we try to do it now, we'd be in trouble.
It's worth remembering that even like when my father was a kid, like in the 30s, they were commuting by like a horse and wagon. They, in no particular part of North Carolina, they didn't have any of these things. So it's not that long ago.
Right.
You know, so it's not necessarily that the world's going to fall apart with any of this, without any of this.
Yeah.
It's just more, like you said, relearning it.
It'll be going out with a whimper, not a bang, in other words.
So how do communication networks get set back up? Because when I went to tour camp, it was in the desert, and it was a bunch of techies and hackers, and it was a security conference that was happening in the desert, and they thought they would have Wi-Fi up and running all the time that was very high power, and it's really difficult to keep one up and running when you don't have these structures.
Right.
Well,
already up.
You got to have experience with those sorts of structures,
mm-hmm.
and not just do it. And think, oh well, I'm gonna do this because I think I can probably do it. But unless you've got real world experience doing things
right.
like that, and on the ground, then you're gonna have to learn as you go. And I think a few days is not really enough to probably learn how to do that. I mean, I run a Wi-Fi network, and it is interesting all the junk that comes up that'll make it fail. And eventually you learn all the things that it takes to make it run. And think anything like that, whether it's medicine or any kind of engineering problem, there's a learning curve.
Right.
You don't have to start at the end, you can start at the beginning.
Yeah.
Wireless, radio, ham radio, very easy to operate. One person could do it, one person could build the ham radio out of transistors.
I got a question. How would satellites continue to operate? Let's say that there was no issue with, let's say our cell phones could remain charged somehow, or we'd solve that problem.
The satellites need ground control.
They need ground control.
Stay in right orbit.
Okay.
And there's a
drift.
Case
and
right.
As soon as they drift out, they fall.
So how about GPS satellites?
To
same. Okay.
Even worse.
Okay.
That's a whole system.
Yeah.
All right.
So all the satellites, the space station, like with the people on it, might stay in orbit. They can probably manually guide it if they have to.
But as soon as they need supplies, where's the rocket come from to help them,
Yeah, they have an escape vehicle.
What?
They have an escape vehicle.
Okay.
So they can fly down.
And get in real trouble that way.
So what kind of apocalypse are you talking about? Like, are we
Just general. I mean, I would love it if we wanted to pick one specific scenario.
Yeah,
what
we have to work with is important. Like, if it's zombies, then we have all the infrastructure intact. We just need to get rid of the zombies.
Let's go with that one. I like zombie apocalypse.
If it's like massive earthquakes and volcanoes and clouds blocking out the sun, then solar power's out.
Yeah.
What about if artificial intelligence can have emotion? There's the picture on y'all's website of the robot and how to have emotional intelligence. So that, for instance, I'm happy I'm here tonight because I'm talking to people and it's fun to talk about. I'm cool and taking things. Can artificial intelligence or one of these robots that are we see all the time in magazines and movies have emotion, or is that possible?
Are you talking about like if it wanted to break down the plan of humanity or something?
Just a robot.
Just a robot that can feel.
Maybe it could.
Yeah.
No reason why not.
Yeah.
Question.
Robert, was it Silverberg? Wrote Positronic Man, basically the first, I guess, talked about basically the first robot. He did feel and he didn't. He kind of grew up. So, I think, what's the name of that movie that they did?
Tron?
Nah,
Bicentennial Man.
Oh.
Exactly.
I'm appalled that I know that.
Well, I was really surprised because I read the book and then I saw the movie. It's like, wow, hey, I've seen that. I've read this. But that's kind of interesting because that's kind of how It did have emotion.
So yeah. Do you think
have to do with apocalypses?
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
do you think that that's an apocalypse because it would change our societal structure to such a degree?
I think that how it would relate would be that if we all lacked emotion and simply did things out of forms, so we just had no emotional content and we just read forms and then enacted the purpose of those
mm-hmm.
forms, then we would definitely have it be apocalyptic. Imagine the repercussions of that.
So you're not talking about AI necessarily having emotion, but as humans losing the ability to have emotion through technological advance, or?
No, I'm just asking a question.
Okay. Does anyone else want to start?
Well, about the emotion side, I don't think that necessarily solves all problems. That is, we tend to appropriately think of emotion as very important, but they overrate it, because part of what emotion is often violence, and that is probably the single biggest factor in the end of humankind, apocalypse, or slowly strangling itself. But the problem is enormous, that emotion isn't the only thing. I mean, to not have emotion is a problem, but to be an emotional hot reactor is not good either. So if you had a robot that had emotion but didn't have the cultural upbringing to know right and wrong, that might be a problem, if you remember how.
Yeah.
One aspect of surviving, talking about emotion, one aspect of surviving apocalypse is probably dealing with all the people who want to fight you for your resources.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the willingness to fight.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I would think that you would need emotion in order to have a sense of self-preservation.
So if you're going to combat, so to speak, is that the haves versus the have-nots, so let's say that you have your bastion of civilization here and the rest of the world is gone, you know, is gone, so you have to either, well, there's two ways I think that you could deal with it. One is that your bastion of civilization would be separated by some sort of distance or physical barrier that would keep everything else away, and then you could export your civilization out, which would be ideal. The other one is that you'd have to probably defend it with violence.
Rogue warrior.
Which would really suck, because
exactly.
Being a rational being and trying to create a civilization for you to have to destroy other people because they want to take your resources and destroy your civilization is a bad thing.
But that's what we're doing right now.
I know.
We're
that's,
playing
that,
out
that,
at a pre-apocalyptic
that,
level.
That's why it's a bad thing.
I mean, a
so
billion people a day are hungry.
We'll
a billion people.
Yeah.
And they're opening up more and more, you know, dog boutiques in Bellevue. I mean,
yeah. So we need to solve that, because otherwise we're headed towards, you know,
SUV.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about the technological apocalypse of
yes.
sorts, singularity.
Yeah.
And first of all, I want to clarify, just to make sure we're all on the same page, is what singularity is, which is it's a term that, at least from my experience, is taken from physics and black holes, where after a certain point you can no longer predict how it's acting, and there's no way to tell. We can't gather information past a certain point. And there is a theory that I assume most of you are well acquainted with of technology progressing at an exponential rate, and at some point we're all going to go into future shock because it's probably self-replicating and self-teaching AI that we won't be able to understand anymore, and everything will be changing at such a rate that we won't be able to deal with it.
There's an interesting math distinction. Is that exponential? The exponential graph doesn't lead to a singularity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
Huh.
What's it lead to? It just keeps going. Like, an exponent can keep going off toward infinite time.
So it's
but,
a steady state?
Yeah. The singularity is when you try to divide by zero.
Right.
So, I think the whole idea of singularity really comes not from the singularity itself, but from the event horizon that surrounds
yeah.
the singularity.
Our own lack of imagination.
But
So I've actually heard of sort of maybe two separate and distinct sort of singularity theories. And so the first one, I think, which largely is what you described, I'll colloquially call the AI foo, where you come up with an AI and it makes itself smarter, essentially over successive generations, and it can start to do magical things because it's got, like, I don't know, it's really awesome, right? The other idea of a singularity has nothing to do with the AI whatsoever. And it's really a compounding of two general trends, right? So increased specialization and an increased pace of technological growth. And so in this scenario, there's no real singularity moment. It's just beyond a certain fuzzy, indistinct point, it's impossible for anyone to know really what's happening with technology. And I guess we're there as to a certain extent right now, but presumably in the future it will become exacerbated even more.
Yeah, that graphic analogy will be a Crab Nebula.
Right.
Then the supernova explode and right. All the fibers and all kind of thing, you know, happening. So maybe that's the singularity for the second term. Nobody can know what is going on.
See, I think we've always had a singularity in our future. During the Renaissance, they could not predict the Industrial Revolution, and during the Industrial Revolution, they could not predict the Information Age. The only difference is now that point at which we can't predict what will come next is possibly within our own lifetimes. So we'll actually have to face it.
Well, you know, there's an interesting counterpoint to that. It's rare for me to be a contrarian, but I will. There's a natural phenomenon that's very scary that's happening. Has anybody read about the giant jellyfish of Japan that flipped over the boat? A bunch of, they're 6 feet, 400 pounds, and there's giant jellyfish, and there's also huge amounts of jellyfish washing up all over the Riviera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We kill the sea turtles that eat hundreds of pounds of these things all the time. And as the turtles go away, the jellyfish increase vastly, and they being a primitive life form, right? There's very little that's going to stop them if you get rid of their natural predator. The same thing is happening with ants in Texas. A certain type of ant has evolved that chews its way through electronic circuits.
Yeah.
And they're called crazy. Look it up on Google. It's creepy. A friend of mine lives in Houston, and it's very real. And they get in your computer, and they short it out.
And the issue with bees.
And
the
attachment to this.
Same thing.
Electric field,
circuits,
but it's also just to get out
going
of
away from
away from predators.
Right.
They're cool places to hide.
So along with the ants and the problem with the ants getting into electrical, there's the bees that are flying away from the nest, and due to pesticides out in public, they are not returning. They're dying out in the field.
Right.
And so the scientists are looking at these bee cultures, and they're figuring out what is in them so that that can be a discussion.
We have become an extinction level event.
Yes, exactly.
And so, and somebody's going to have to deal with it, or it's going to move the needle.
It may not be, you know, nuclear or technological things that get our ass. It's basically life that we've stepped on enough times bounces up and says, dinner. And there's nobody between them and us. It could be bacterial, viral.
Well, I think the thing with the jellyfish,
yeah.
I actually hadn't read about that one. I just read about the increase in giant jellyfish.
Right.
So the difference between a natural or an indigenous species and an invasive species is that all species move around.
Right.
Regardless of plant, animal, whatever. But they all move around. It's the rate that they come into an environment.
Right.
And so I think it's really interesting the backlash of that, because usually we bring new creatures in and they wipe everything out. I think it's interesting that we're wiping something out and something new is coming.
Everything's going to fill whatever ecological niche becomes vacant.
Right, that's the whole secret, because the more we eliminate habitat, the more habitat, the type of animals and critters that live in the reduced habitat are sort of monocultures or monotypes, and there's no diversity, and they're garbage eaters, basically.
Can we eat jelly?
Huh?
Can we eat jelly?
Yeah. Some, not all kinds.
Yeah, that's very. Yeah, actually, that's one of the easiest digestible.
Yes.
Protein.
Yeah, right.
I don't see a problem.
So it's a very high value, actually.
Interesting.
The problem is the gray goo problem, like nanotechnology.
See.
It's going to get over everything. Jellyfish get over everything once they're on the shore. It's not like you can eat them.
Well,
they cover
if,
everything.
If slime. You want to get into scary creatures
yeah.
taking over, you could talk about the Humboldt squid.
Yes,
and how because
one.
The habitat of certain fish has gotten bigger because there's warmer water everywhere and
right.
the Humboldt squid eat them. They're called devil squid
oh.
because there are stories from legitimate sources but no film documentaries of them actually coming, like, pulling people off of ships.
Absolutely true.
There was, I saw a video
and,
of
yeah.
In Baja, they were in Baja, and I
yeah.
saw a video of basically this guy, and they're like, they're not that big, but they were like, they school, and so it's multiple attacks.
And,
like,
and they're learning how to be, you know, this grouping mm-hmm. stuff. That's one of the biggest
mm-hmm.
things that got humankind going off the African plains is when we cooperated.
So how do we
and
survive that apocalypse
huh?
of the animal kingdom coming
yeah.
back to get us?
See, that's a cool one in a way, because we know what's going on.
Has anyone read a book called Earth Abides? It was written by Michael Cordes.
Earth Abides?
Earth Abides. It was like one of the original post-apocalyptic books. And so, like, in it, like somehow, like, mankind is practically wiped off the face of the planet, and they don't really go into why. You know, because it's easy not to. But then once mankind is gone, there was an influx of rats. And then after the rats, then there's an influx of snakes. And then after that, there's an influx of something else. And so, like, basically, according to the narrator, the theory is that, like, you know, as, like, you know, one predator man goes down, then, like, this another species goes up, but then the species that feeds on that has an upsurge of population, and so on and so forth. But, you know, just basically in the book, this fictional book, like, basically, you know, there's just, like, he's just, like, watching, you know, on a Wednesday, there's, like, you know, hordes of rats going down the streets of San Francisco, and then on Thursday, there's, like, hordes of snakes or something like that,
yeah.
you know.
This is the scenario of, you know, I'm not a hater of Islam, but a non-technological civilization will go into that scenario. It's like East Island, you know, one
yeah.
day, you know, collapsed and wiped out. But the other scenario is like that, you know, without technology, you know, people will be replaced by another species like that. So Afghanistan or, you know, that kind of civilization, you know, or backward, will, you know, invite that kind of scenario.
Well, see, I see it more as like a type of people, you know, like basically we don't have, you know, even here, like we don't have like scientists saying, okay, let's figure out how this works. You might have other people saying, well, let's just, you know, leave it up to God and the Bible
right.
or something like that.
Yeah.
More of a type of person rather than.
I think this type of apocalypse would worry me less than most of the others, because this is, we have this massive human-created environment that is being spread all over the world, and if there is a apocalypse, then there will be a shrinking human population and of the human-created environment, which means that the creatures which are created with the apocalypse would no longer be able to sustain cells and die out.
There's something I've always found, what's it called? Reassuring. It doesn't matter really what happens. Like, I saw this special one. It doesn't matter what happens, but I saw this. There's a thing called Journey of Man. And so they were doing DNA studies, and then all of Europe was descended from 50 individuals. And it was interesting that then they did genetic testing of Native Americans. And they figured that all of Native American population were descended from anywhere from 20 to as few as 12 individuals. So it doesn't take that large of a population to survive for species to continue.
There's a minimum size for genetic viability.
Yeah.
It's between, yeah. It's like,
I think it might even be less than that.
Two dozen.
Yeah, it's not very.
But, you know, if you lose all your genes because, I mean, we're assuming, and it's a good assumption, that most apocalyptic stories are local in the sense that the whole globe doesn't get wiped out. Typically, that would be a war. There's still going to be survivors and so forth. Technology.
But don't have that to eat during winter.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, but the problem could be just volcanoes. you know, natural phenomena, obliterating the sun for a few years, and they're going to grow your crops. And so you have to mass starvation. And
what
there's this whole other
thing. What I think is important is that we do as much as possible with our intellectual, our vastly wise human body, and find the solutions to our condition, you know, and to do that, there are, you know, the simple, you know, things first, and then step taking to the next thing, and those need to not create violence. Those need to not create
unsustainable things.
Destruction. Richard Dawkins, right? Richard Dawkins, evolutionary stable steps, so that we are progressing. And, you know, and what those are, you know, those, you know, and how they can connect to technology is another question. But the what they are, you know, they're the basic things. They're the things that we all already have. They're the things that we already do and know and you know, hopefully they manifest into some technologies that will allow us to stay away from apocalypse.
That's kind of like the most basic question of, like, you know, the whole survivalist thing, where, like, basically, you know, someone says, well, you know, worst comes to worst, I'm just going to barricade myself behind a wall and look after me and mine. Well, in the long run, is that really going to serve them well? And no, probably your approach of, like, you know, cooperating and, you know,
right.
You know, it might sound idealistic to, you know, try to be nonviolent, you know, try to cooperate, but probably in the end, that's what got us where we
are. It's the only choice we have.
Exactly. It's only
basically, I mean, because that's the single thing that can get us all, because we're not all on the same page at the same time.
Yeah.
That's the single biggest global problem. And we're solving it, you know, with technology to a certain extent, you know, the internet and so forth. But that doesn't mean we all experience our environment at the same time and have the same political or religious or sensibilities about things. And so we're kind of at different levels at different times. We don't have a sort of a unified Earth that develops all together in, you know, in similar ways. More like fits and starts. And so there's huge holes where you have violent potential. People don't have water, they don't have food. You know, there's a lot of pressure that's going to occur that we haven't seen yet. That's going to be far worse than terrorism.
When you look at Katrina, where, like, they were saying, oh yeah, there's going to be like rampaging mobs, black people versus white people, you know, and everyone's going to be fighting over food. And look at that guy with the red, obviously he's looting. And meanwhile, like down there on the ground, like basically they're popping and going, hey, you need some bread? I noticed there's some bread in this convenience
right.
store. Here,
yeah.
here you go. You
yeah,
know?
It was really weird because everybody on the outside is like, oh my god, and it's like going, these people are, you know.
Of course, there's going to be.
But if a year down the road,
yeah.
Let's revisit those people after the bread is gone. See, my concern isn't the initial goodwill that people have during a disaster. It's when it sets in and it's year after year and people
yeah.
are in cliques. And, yeah, well, gee, they seem to be getting more than us. And, you know, there's a peculiar thing about people and groups.
Deal?
So, I don't know how much, like, survivalist literature people here have been exposed to. My guess is that most survivalists run in different circles from this crowd. But there's an interesting guy that I've been following who lives in Argentina. I don't know if you guys know what happened to Argentina. But basically, it went from being like, I don't know, number, in the top 10 economies of the world, to being a 2.5 world nation. At least from what this guy is telling me, I'm not sure what the official statistics are. But, and so he gives a lot of these survivalist guys a pretty hard time, because sort of the thing that most people like kind of fantasize about is running off to the woods with their guns in like a shack, and they've got like, you know, 5 years worth of food, and they're gonna hunt for their food or whatever, and like not gonna see anyone. And that doesn't happen. Like, even when, you know, the Roman Empire collapsed and the Dark Ages set in, the civilization didn't go away. You know, there's still lots of people walking around. I mean, people survived the Ice Age, and they did it well enough that they were able to hunt to extinction all the other massive land mammals with like fire and sharp stones and pointy sticks.
And cooperation.
Certainly cooperation. But I guess the point is that you know, when you talk about apocalypse, I think that it's much more likely to see maybe a partial collapse of things. Certainly, this has a very big potential to be, you know, big problems, because there's a lot of people in the world, and one of the big things that's keeping a lot of them alive is stuff like the Green Revolution. And if you don't have access to that sort of technology anymore, then you run into problems. But,
there's also problems that we're creating, that the same countries that have benefited from that are facing a new crisis, you know, because there's more and more people on land that can't sustain them, and flooding and so forth. Then look at Bangladesh, for example. You know, very highly populated, very small area. And every time the floods move in, more and more people die each year. And you say, well, why don't they move somewhere else? Well, they can't. There's no somewhere else. And the reason it gets worse each year is not just that the weather's worse, it's that more and more people. And every place you look on the planet where you have population increases without sustainable balance for it, you start creating these centers of problems that are going to, you know, become the riots in the future.
Another potential problem is that the big cities in the West and in Europe were built near productive agricultural areas, and now that cities have been expanding, they have started to pave over the ancient agricultural centers. And so it's going to be more difficult to get food than it was 500 years ago.
I think it's easier to sustain a population that's close-knit, such as a city. I mean, this is based on still having electricity, and transportation, but it's more sustainable, better for the environment, and better for the individual to be in a city than it is to try to populate the countryside.
I don't agree.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Really? Why. Here's why. At the beginning, again, the goodwill is there. The city's a great place. When the supermarkets become empty and there's no more filling them,
yeah, that's why I said
you can't flush your toilet anymore.
It's still based on transportation, so bringing in food.
And a lot of those cities are built at the site called ports. Yeah,
yes.
Nowadays, if it's been beyond it, especially suburbs, you know, it's all another thing. But that's something to think about. There's a different intent where this one pointed out that, like, if you look at the city, and you see, like, the main, you know, Market Street, that's because that's where the market was.
Right.
You see, you know, the fishmongers square, that's because that's where the fishmongers were, you know. So it might, just geodes that might contract. The city will probably
come
back to its original size, but we'll still be
there. Yeah, when,
like you said, that's...
But I heard some unconfirmed rumor that the Detroit, city of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
losing so much jobs, and the price of real estate is collapsing,
mm-hmm.
government is coming in, destroy the whole city,
mm-hmm.
so that there is a sense of, you know, price not collapsing. So it's just cutting out the whole city.
Because Detroit was founded on what? The auto?
Yes.
Train.
Yeah,
so
there's a transportation hub.
So it's just erasing whole city, basically. Because otherwise, you know, $1 house, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not a normal situation, not acceptable situation for civilized country.
There's also some, like Detroit, there's some pretty interesting permaculture stuff going on there too, basically. So they're growing enormous amounts of food in a very small space by using sustainable practices, compost and stuff like that, basically providing, again, food for the population. There's no reason why we can't use that kind of technology, just that we're not using that right now, like the 100-mile diet sort of thing, which we were talking about earlier. It's very, I think it's important if you're going to try to stem something like this off, or in case something like this happens, because there needs to be enough coming in that you're not going to have like a large amount of people, you know, starving.
In agreement with you now, the city is good because you have hydroponics and vertical farms.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a solution, you know, in very dense areas. How much food can you raise in a small area? A lot.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Aztecs. I mean, or
exactly.
Various places down there, they've really had
terracing and the Chinese.
Not to mention the main benefit of cities that you have all these different people together that have all the skills that you need. You know, if you don't know anything about farming, you don't have to.
Right.
You know, that'll still be true. You
just have to be willing to actually work on the farm. It teaches you how.
Well, it's an important,
might do other things.
Or you
it's
might
an important component to stay tuned into the earth and being able to recognize when these possible apocalyptic things are happening is to stay, you know, into maybe grow a couple plants, you know, so that you can notice these rhythms occurring and you know have an open air in the room, so that, you know, oxygen can come in, you know, you're creating your own place so that when the apocalypse does come, you're kind of aware with your surroundings.
I think that it would also, it's also a good thing to have a vague idea of how growing plants works, and just in general, it's a good skill to have. It's one I don't have. I kill anything. I try
tomato. I did it this year, and I'm bad at it. So easy to do. Just tomatoes. They feel great.
So, in that vein, this is something that I've actually been really interested in. Who here can make steel from scratch?
Actually,
cool. I can make bad steel.
I want to talk to you.
How about
later.
Bad steel?
I never said it was like high quality.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
What do you mean from scratch?
Like if you
iron ore.
Yeah, I can
you
do that.
Dig it out of the ground.
Do you know,
yeah, I can
do
that.
Steel.
Do you know how I can do that? I will tell you right now. I need a magnet and go to a stream where there are many ion rich sand. Sand, you know. Sand has some area, a lot of iron, so you collect that with some brown bag or whatever, you know, many. Then you have to make a charcoal, right?
Right.
You know, there is, if you, you know, cut the wood and then asphyxiate, you know, burn it, but asphyxiate.
Right.
Then it becomes charcoal,
right?
Then you need low.
A lot of
know?
Oxygen.
Yeah, so you... You make some mud kiln and add the you know, iron rich sand and the charcoal. Then you have to blow, you know, with your handmade blower.
Yeah, I think the point
then
that
of the days you can make up your iron tools. Right?
I think the point that Theo is making though is that there are some very, and this might be jumping the gun on this, but there are some very rudimentary things that we rely on that we definitely don't even think about.
Absolutely. Iron is good, but how about aluminum or titanium?
Who needs a
wood?
Just talk.
I get what your point of rudimentary skills and lack of the circle. With the amount of sheer graph keys I've made in the past couple hundred years, I don't have to
there's a lot of third world countries, really. They got steel everywhere. They just, you know, just repurpose it for their own. But I would like to do that. But
and
as a project.
Note,
yes.
Just a quick fact, you can actually make a forge out just by digging a small channel in the earth, so you don't even need a clay kiln. Sorry, I was switching to the
phone. That's cool.
I actually want to dispute that. No, the there will be crap all over the place. It will be fine.
Okay, I guess it went to the middle of the apocalypse.
So, I spent a year in Iraq, and it is ridiculous how quickly stuff just gets scavenged over there.
Oh yeah.
Because they don't have infrastructure there to make things. Like, they do everything by hand. They make cement by hand. They build buildings by hand. They're all like I don't know if you see like old school drawings of like the way people lived. I don't know, 6,000 years. Yeah, that's the way they make buildings there right now. Like, they've got the, what is that? Like mud bricks and like pieces of wood to keep up the ceiling and stuff.
I guess my advice came from a strictly Western standpoint of the fact that if we removed everything from Seattle and we had, let's say the technical humans in Seattle, we still have enough material to create something else out of that. So I guess I was just thinking from a strictly Western standpoint.
Well, I mean,
if you ever take the train up to New York, you see plenty of shit.
I'm a little deaf, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you ever take the train up to New York and you, like, you know, go past all those old factories, you're just looking at, like,
but then that brings up another point of how many people here can weld. Okay, do you know how to weld if you don't have a blowtorch?
I know how to weld if I have wood and a hammer.
Yeah.
There's also a way to weld with a car battery and a hanger, but it's terrible.
You can also weld with friction. You rub two things together and they will eventually get hot.
The car battery and the hanger.
Friction welding is what friction stir welds.
What is the car battery and the hanger?
It's a terrible idea.
DC welder works in the same way. It's the same principle.
Yeah.
So.
Is it selected
electric
arc?
But the amount of power you would need to do anything.
That's real
knowledge.
How does that work? Do you know how the process?
If you look at the Steampunk's Guide to the Apocalypse, they talk about it in that.
Really?
Yes.
But welding is not that sophisticated a thing. I mean,
right.
That's a good question about, you know, weld. But if you ask how many people know how to run a chip foundry, I don't think there's any hands on
silicon
foundry to actually manufacture.
Yeah, that would be the hard thing.
That's
our technology.
Because that's
really
what
difficult.
It's chips, not iron, that we live around.
Yeah. So let's kind of wrap things up a little bit.
Yeah.
This can still take a while, but how do you think the conversation that we have been having about how we think an apocalypse is survivable, or how we would do it, or what kinds of apocalypses might happen, is different from a conversation that would happen elsewhere because of the views that we hold?
I think that, what's your name again?
Theo.
Theo brought up a really good point. I always looked at, like, the collapse of anything would be very similar to Iraq, where you lose your infrastructure.
Right.
I mean, how do you go back from that? I mean, you've got to be able to, somebody has to be able to go in and go, here's an infrastructure. You have to have a mobile infrastructure that you can take anywhere and then replicate it. And
you
can't
do that.
You
basically have to bootstrap it. But in a city, when you have millions of people and hundreds of thousands of acres, I mean, the sheer size of it is what is daunting. It's not that the knowledge isn't there, or even the skill of people, but to do something on the scale that's needed to satisfy a market, or provide something. For example, in the United States, we kill 10 billion animals every year for food. 10 billion.
But
around
we
the world,
raise
100 billion animals. Every year, we raise them, we use up all the soil and water just to raise cows. And then the cows fart, and the methane makes holes in the ozone. You know, I mean, it's crazy. Well, that's why you want to be a vegan. If you really care about sustainability, you want to stop.
Actually,
cows.
If you really want to be sustainable,
yeah.
Don't have kids.
Even better, I agree. And if you do, don't let them eat hamburgers.
Don't have, or don't have a dog.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Or don't exist.
Yeah.
No, but
so
you know,
anyway, though, how does?
I'm optimistic. I think our conversation's more optimistic than those people out there.
Okay.
I agree.
Because they're going to envision Road Warrior with chainsaws and chaos.
And what we're mean, looking at people in robes sitting around with great conversations by the baths.
And your earth shelter with the water
exactly.
The cistern
and you,
coming in.
And you, you're the greatest tomato raiser. You don't know this.
Theo?
So I guess, I'm sorry I'm bringing this up so late, but I did want to bring up one last point. And that is that it,
it's kind of weird saying this because we've been like we're in the midst or at the tail end, depending on your view, of this huge like 600 year kick of like straight advancement. But there is a concept, I know it's not very popular, but there's a concept called the anti-singularity, where essentially the quality of governments decreases. It is, there's crime, there's a lack of spending on education, technology just sort of kind of goes away. And it's happening right now. So I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to what's going on in Africa, for example. Zimbabwe, of course, is the poster child. But 10 years ago, it was nowhere near as bad as it is today. And if you look at South Africa today, I don't know the exact statistics, but from what I understand, it's about like what Zimbabwe was 10 years ago. And they used to, at one point, have a nuclear bomb. I doubt they can build one now. But there's definitely parts of the world which are going backwards, so to speak. They're not progressing, they're regressing.
Look at Russia, with the age, lifespan is dropping. You know where else in the planet does that happen?
Here in America.
No, that's infant mortality.
No, the current generation of American children will enjoy a shorter lifespan than their parents.
Is that,
yeah. There are several studies that support that.
All I wanted to say was this, that progress is not something that's inevitable. And that I think that some of the things that are going on today are kind of worrisome to me. And that it seems to me that in order to escape the Malthusian trap, that is, in order to not live at subsistence level, you need constant technological innovation. And if that doesn't happen for any variety of reasons, then life will start to suck a lot.
What's the biggest obstacle?
It depends on your political outlook.
I'm
not going to get into that right now.
Yeah. Education or the will to... Progress.
For whatever reason, there are several pockets in the world today which are not progressing, they're regressing. And I think it's
in our viewpoint. So, and from a lot of the things that we look at, and I'm not disagreeing with you on that, I'm just going to make every generation thinks that they're the best and the last. And that.
Starvation is on no one's list of stuff that they want to do.
Right, but I wonder what the causes of that regression are. They were getting aid that they weren't, or that they weren't before, and now it's being taken away. If it was like, I think there are so many factors involved with that, and there's also the idea that, yes, starvation is fucking horrific. But just because our children are going to live not as long of a lifespan as we are does not mean that there are not other advances being made that we just don't see right now.
Right.
Not to mention who has what. I mean, you could say, Africa's now going into a hellhole, right? Or maybe when the British were in charge, British or French were in charge, maybe it looked like it was a great place. But then maybe if you were living at the bottom of the run, it looked pretty much the same. It's like sometimes history is a wave to go forward
and
go back.
Well, East Germany, or what was East Germany? People missing
all the
communist
regime.
We weren't alive anymore.
Yeah, I don't disagree that it sucks, but it's kind of interesting to see where it came from.
It's also my understanding that as societies become wealthier, their fertility rates are decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
Or this has been true for quite some time, and that. Once the quality of life increases, we will focus more on on reproduction toward the carrying capacity. So you don't need to keep introducing new advances which will raise the carrying capacity, because maybe instead of reproducing for our selection, we'll go to case selection and we'll just have a sustainable population naturally. It's happening by choice.
I mean, it's not like
but it's
Canadian woman
or
incapable
but it's happening
having
all over the world. And it's happening over all over the world. And it seems to be happening fairly consistently according to how wealthy societies are and access to ground control.
Right, but
that's
a choice. Yeah. That's a cultural problem. That's not biological. You know, women are not suddenly, because when they become rich, they're suddenly
but the cultural choice is influenced by their biology, and biology influences culture. And there's all sorts of societies, all sorts of creatures which have reproductive strategies of minimalist babies and make them.
Yeah, I know, but I have to disagree with that comparison to human reproductive choices.
Before you disagree, can I clarify, because I'm not sure what you're saying. Okay, so what I hear you saying is that there needs to be a base point where we look at, like, that it's okay. Like, there needs to be some sort of ground footing, and that understanding has to have then some sort of reproductive capability.
I'm saying that...
Is that close? Is that close to what you're saying?
I'm going to clarify what I'm saying, that the sort of Malthusian concern is that people are going to keep reproducing, and eventually we will, that we will exceed the ability of the planet to sustain people, and then we'll die off or something, or the quality of life will go down. But it seems like as we approach the maximum population of the Earth or the land in a certain area, the population that sometimes, in our case, the women start having as many children, and so the population stabilizes. So instead of being a curve like that, you get a curve like that.
So we had a boom in population when we started industrializing because people were still having children at the same rate that they were before, which is lots and lots of kids because they expected a third of them to die. But because we had sanitation and better healthcare, more of those children were living, and so you have a huge boom in population before people figure out they don't need to keep popping out so many babies.
And
so it's a similar...
England and the early industrial societies, it took something like 30 years people to realize this, and in third world countries, as this is happening, it's taking like 20 years or so for this change to happen.
Oh, they seem to pick things up a lot faster. Birth access and access to birth control, but like, for instance, I follow this site called Afrotech, and they actually adopt technology fast. I mean, they're using cell phones, computer networks, they're actually doing mesh networks and things like that, whereas, you know, here we're...
Because we had to develop it from scratch, and they can borrow it. It's a lot easier to make changes when you can borrow things.
Exactly.
Well,
engineer from scratch, yeah.
But my conclusion is that the culture and the civilization doesn't grow, evolve naturally. The natural curve is degeneration. It happened in many countries. So recently, look at Russia. Russia collapsed. They made a revolution and made improvement, but it fell down. America is another example. You know, right now it's going down, and it will continue to going down. The birth rate will reduce, but the total volume of population will grow, even though it's a slower growth. So that doesn't help, because without solution, population, net population growth, although the rate is reducing. So all the scenario, is basically decays until people become no smile, no laughter, unbearable, and then something can happen, hopefully. But that's the current trend of the globe, very pessimistic.
Do you think we notice it more now because we're in the world and we're in a decline? Yeah. Was that 20 years ago, everything was much better, would we feel so pessimistic?
And that was before
we
got to hawk, $2 trillion to the Chinese for all the super junk we bought.
Yeah, but you always thought America would be always up there, is it?
I think it's India's turn in a couple of years. Because they're finally tapering off their buck. That's the biggest problem in India. But they're already bigger than China. Yeah, they've already exceeded. So that, you know, if you think of it this way, one out of four people on the planet, you know, say about 2050 is going to be either India or China. You know, so you have to think of those countries when you're talking about future.
This is all incredibly interesting, but I want to wrap it up so
sure.
I can go dancing.
Speaking of positive stuff, right?
So, again, how does the way we talk about this, what about it makes, is because we're futurists and cyberpunks and transhumanists and posthumanists.
Yeah, that's why
we know how to do stuff.
We're tilling our understanding, and we are ascertaining our identity, our abilities, and our pieces of our elements. We're tilling that up, and we're going through this process that is looking at them all, and we realize that everything is in circularity. America is going through this process where we're taking it apart, we're piecing it together.
So you think
so we're taking it apart, we're piecing it together again, and then we're stepping back and we're reframing it. Things that are those elements, those technologies are there. We're going through it, and we're tilling through a metaphor.
So
cyberpunk would be that we are going through, and we are identifying all this stuff, and we're saying, you know what? All this is anxiety, and we get into a conversation on the street, and maybe we bump into somebody that says, you know, hey, what's up? Or they look over at the cyberpunk's little page, and they say, all right, well, cyberpunks are saying that artificial intelligence really doesn't have emotional content in it or something. You know, that somebody looks at it, some person reads it, and then he writes an article in another magazine, and then that goes on. And then he writes another article in a magazine, and then some scientist kicks over it and he says, wow.
So you think
this isn't going on, and this in my lab is doing this.
So you think it's a self-awareness and awareness of how systems work? And being in touch with how things work and being able to realize that it's able to be reconstructed.
Yeah, that's why I want to make Seattle one of the foremost places in the world where there is two transhuman group.
Yes.
Let's
talk about that in just a minute. Right now, does anyone have any other?
I think that the futurist perspective depends on the current infrastructure and the current way that the world is moving, and extrapolate that into the future, and trying to predict what's going to happen, not now, but how things would be if society doesn't collapse, and that if society does collapse, then it's kind of cut off, you can't really do any of that, and the best thing to do is to preserve knowledge we have so that what society does rebuild, we can get there faster.
Yeah, I think Burke's quote says the best way to predict the future is to create it, and I think that as transhumanist or whatever you want to call it, somebody that looks to the future rather than waiting for something to happen, is that we actually go out and create the future we want. And I think that's
working on rebuilding technology around this,
right? Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a part of
rebuilding technology, you said?
Rebuilding technology rather than just surviving.
Rebuilding technology.
Are just surviving.
Why you are saying technology? I challenge you. No. Why you are so stuck with technology? Do you think that's a solution?
I'm just trying to survive.
That's insane. You know, that's insane.
No,
what's
I think
the definition of technology?
Do you mean technology is like any tool that we use, or do you mean?
It could be a social thing too. A social network or a belief system is actually a technology. I mean, how you do things. If your greed makes it so you must have everything and nobody else has anything else, I mean, I don't know if you want to call that a technology, but it's a.
I think that's a good summation.
Actually, I have a question for you, sir.
You had said the best way to predict the future is the planet.
Is it is created?
Okay, let's say that we identify transhumans something that we target.
Well,
I'm just trying to answer because I don't understand the term.
I don't know what it means either. Actually,
that's why we're all here.
Let's say we all got together and we had hammered out a recruited amongst plans. Like, we knew that something would happen. We had an apocalypse. We had a plan for what we do. Do you really think we could maintain that plan if we didn't share the same belief system? Like, let's say that it's transhumanist and people who don't believe what we believe. Do you really think any plan we make would stand up?
Well. Ideally, that you would have people that have the similar beliefs, and I think also that everybody maybe should do their own thing, and the one that survives or does better, then they might be able to adopt that sort of thing and work on an evolutionary system. Hopefully, this other group over here is not going to die, but they'll say, "Well, this group over here is doing much better than we are. Maybe we should do what they do."
You're picturing like a different group's functioning. I'm picturing us having a group and people going, "Hey, our group is working. Let's tear down the door and take their stores of bread and eat it."
Yeah, see, that's the problem with being at a localized. Ideally, you'd be like someplace out in the ocean, floating on the ocean someplace, or in space. Space might be a better location because if you're really
Yes, exactly.
No, I'm off of hamburgers.
Yeah. If anyone wants a good movie to convince them to go vegan, I'd like a commercial.
Oh, man.
It's called Earthlings. Have you seen that?
No.
Type it in, Earthlings. It's been downloaded, and it's a great movie. And it covers all the different things from leather to meat to pets to rodeos. You know.